Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
I'm at the casino until roughly 4 a.m.
In the wee hours of the morning, after all have gone to bed.
I leave the casino. I get home within 20 minutes. I had an apartment that was close by.
Yes, I go all to myself. Think of things that you have said.
You know, regular night. I go to bed.
Yeah, but I fall asleep weary of wonder.
I get woken up to a loud pounding on the door.
If there is anything for me.
It's either you're getting robbed, someone trying to knock down the door, or the cops. So I grab my gun right away to defend the house. I always have a lot of cash in my safe.
Too young.
Then I hear. I just put my gun down, I go open the door.
But when you looked at me and smiled,
hands up.
That's when it all began.
That's Ray. He surrendered to the FBI right then and there. If you asked me when we were kids where Ray would end up, honestly, I would say right here. Handcuffed in his Gucci shorts and Gucci slides, flashing his newly minted veneers as the neighbors stood there gawking. He was probably more worried about how pale and skinny he looked, and less worried about the handcuffs on his wrists. For as long as I could remember, Ray was always good at making a couple pennies. The problem was, didn't matter how. Ray Trapani was being arrested for fraud. Conspiracy to commit security fraud, more specifically. And conspiracy to commit wire fraud. For what, you might ask? Well, Ray's company was called Centratech, and he was one of the founders. During the summer of 2017, Centratech became a massive success, raising millions of dollars from investors. A-list celebrities like Floyd Mayweather and DJ Khaled touted the company as the next big thing. And their success wasn't limited to the US. Centratech went global. Two kids from New York were gonna change the world. Until they didn't. And I'm here to tell you why.
You know, I wonder, will I ever be back with you?
Ray and his partners raised millions of dollars on false promises and partnerships that they claimed would disrupt the financial industry. And they made these claims across interviews, social media, and email. When Centratech launched, not only had they caught the attention of hundreds of investors, but also the SEC and FBI. Law enforcement had rarely come across a crime like this before. Centratech was something new, novel, unregulated. The opportunity to deceive was high, and the stakes were massive. By the time the feds caught up with Ray and his partners, the initial funds that were raised had turned into a lot of money. And when I say a lot of money, according to the pending class action lawsuit, we're talking billions of dollars. That's a billion, with a capital B. I'm Johnny B. Good, and this is Creating a Con. The story of Bitcoin. Episode 1, Breaking Bad.
This SEC crackdown on initial coin offerings They made two arrests of the co-founders of an ICO that was backed and promoted by Floyd Mayweather, DJ Khaled.
The founders of that company, they've been indicted now for defrauding investors in the course of operating their company, Centra Tech.
They found rampant plagiarism, identity theft, fake executive teams. The danger is there's manipulation, there's fraud, and people don't know the difference.
Ray was mixed up in one of the largest financial crimes of the decade. He found himself far away from home and in a shit ton of trouble. His company, Centra Tech, found itself directly in the crosshairs of the feds. And as the FBI and SEC turned their eyes on Ray, well, he was fucked. But Ray wasn't the only one who'd lose everything.
I threw my phone on the floor. I was like, I invested how much money into this shit?
All of Centra Tech's investors would see their valuable investment in the company evaporate instantly.
When my assets went from $3 million to zero overnight, I went onto Centra Tech's website. It just said shut down and you had no answers.
Ray and his partners were lying to, stealing from, and cheating unwitting investors. And they left a lot of destruction in their wake.
It did lead to a lot of family trauma. And ultimately, I haven't spoken to my father in 4 years now.
All right, you might be thinking, some shithead ripped off a lot of people. Why the fuck should I care? Sounds like something I've seen on Netflix. Guess what? You probably have. And that shithead you're talking about, well, he happens to be my best friend. And before you start judging me, you have to understand, growing up, Ray was basically a member of my family. Sometimes I'd come home late from a cello lesson or some shit, only to find Ray there playing Nintendo in my room. As we got a little older, I knew he was getting into shady shit, but he was like my brother. I knew the things he did for money weren't exactly legal, but so what? We've all got that friend or relative. If you don't, I promise you that you do. The thing is, people don't just turn to a life of crime overnight. Ray was no different. He wasn't always a criminal, at least not before the age of 10. It was an evolution. Didn't matter if he was selling drugs or one of the most prolific con artists of all time. To me, Ray Trapani was always just that quirky kid from Atlantic Beach who always had my back. Growing up in AB, there was a lot of money around us. It's a white-collar town with blue-collar running through its veins. Ray saw early on, money was within his grasp.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. You know, I believed I could speak it into existence.
Ray never lacked confidence, that's for sure. But it was more than that. Certain things are placed on a pedestal in Atlantic Beach. If you walk into the town hall, you'll see a sign poster of The Sopranos. That should tell you everything you need to know about the town's values.
I always wanted to be a criminal when I was a kid. I was fascinated with, you know, Catch Me If You Can, Wolf of Wall Street, these type of movies.
And guess what? That's exactly what Ray did. He became a career criminal. While friends were at grad school, working on Wall Street, or busting their ass trying to break through as a writer like me, my best friend was plotting and scheming toward his next big payday. But to understand how Ray Trapani ended up surrendering to the FBI and facing over 100 years in prison, we need to go back to where his story begins, in Atlantic Beach, New York.
Your room?
Oh, you're cramped back there.
You guys are both meds.
Yeah, I know. You're the one that got this stupid car.
Good thing I don't have my old car.
Yeah, my car probably has more room.
This is Long Beach. Atlantic Beach is just like the private sector of Long Beach.
This is a beautiful neighborhood. Like, this is like where we use a skateboard all the time.
This is Putnam.
Putnam is where I used to live.
No, you live on Rensselaer.
No, Putnam is a street away from where I used to live. Like, plaza you're thinking of.
I'm terrible with like geography. Geography.
He has a way with words, doesn't he?
Long Beach is really like what people know. It's where people come to surf and party. And Atlantic Beach is just like all the rich people that don't want to live in the craziness of Long Beach. They just live in Atlantic Beach.
Atlantic Beach, or AB as we call it, carried a reputation. And the kids that lived there did too. We weren't so much degenerates, but we weren't not. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, we always had each other's backs. The town, it thrived off hedonism. We went to high school in Lawrence. If you've ever seen Goodfellas, you probably heard of it. By sophomore year, my parents were done with Atlantic Beach, so we relocated to Florida. It was not my choice. My parents were afraid of Ray's influence on me. They wanted to separate us, and my dad knew relocating was the only way. Can you imagine? My parents decided to move our entire family to another state because of bad influences. But here we are. Ray was always a little different. His outlook on life, it wasn't the same as mine. Everything he learned on the streets of Atlantic Beach, and from his family, especially his grandfather.
For as long as I can remember, I was always trying to make a couple pennies.
A couple pennies is actually my grandfather saying, no matter what it was, no matter how much, it's always a couple pennies.
It didn't matter how or why, I was always gonna find a way to make money. I saw other people doing it, and I knew I could do it better.
Everything around me was illegal. Like, my brothers were all selling weed. My grandfather's kind of like a mafia criminal. He's like the one that's carrying the family financially. And my mom's busting her ass. I'm like, one day I'll be able to help my mom and pay all her bills.
I always thought Ray's pop was in the mafia. Just never heard him say it before. Ray's desire for wealth was born out of his surroundings.
This is my house growing up, was over here with the trampoline and all this crazy shit. I don't know what crackhead moved in here, but it looks worse than it did.
It looks exactly the same.
My mom bought that house on foreclosure to put us in a good neighborhood.
Ray's dad was out of the picture by the time Ray was born.
My mom worked all week in the hospital, like ICU, just to like kind of make sure we were able to pay the mortgage. Living like above our means in a nice town.
That nice town, the nice neighborhood Ray's mom, Kerry Trapani, wanted for her son, well, it came at a cost.
We were the poorest people on the block, let's put it that way. But they knew that they were loved, you know, and they knew that they were safe. And that was the most important thing to me.
My family's broke, and my mom's busting her ass 80 hours a week, killing herself. And then, like, all my friends around me, they don't have to hustle. Their mom's not killing herself. They're all stay-at-home moms, and, you know, like, their dad's just, like, a stockbroker or owns some big business. So, like, you're always chasing basic life, and then everybody around you is, like, well off. It's very hard not to be like, oh, I gotta get to where they're at. That made me very me against the world.
I think a lot of people that grow up around more wealthy people and are struggling as a kid tend to do illegal activity. And they're also the more flashy people, which I always was. It's like a poor man's quality is like that flashiness.
Ray was always flashy. And come to think of it, so was his grandfather, William Hagner. Bill, or as Ray called him, Pop, was the family patriarch, the protector. In many ways, he would shape who Ray Trapani would become.
So back in the day, my grandfather, he's a bigger guy, very tan, super German, fucking always a lot of gold on, like your prototypical not Italian mobster, but he looked like a mobster. He was the head elevator inspector for New York City. The correlation between that and organized crime, the elevator unions are always the most shady unions because they control all the flow in any construction job because you need an elevator to bring windows or anything to the next floor, right? So every job that went on in New York City, you know, he obviously got a piece of that. But he was just a super connected guy.
If there was one thing that Ray got from his grandfather, it was loyalty. Pop always supported him. Ray was his blood.
My grandfather was always on my side, no matter what. He didn't know what the fuck I was doing. Oh, Ray has a business idea. Let's give it a try.
Pop was the one male influence in his life that would encourage him, support him. Pop instilled loyalty in Ray. He always had Ray's back. And that stuck with him. Hell, Ray even has a tattoo that says loyalty running up the side of his torso. But that's the thing about Ray. If you're in his inner circle, he's loyal to you to the day he dies. But if he doesn't know you, he'll be the first to fuck you over and leave you with nothing on the side of the road. Ray was attracted to that power, that influence. He saw firsthand how his grandfather operated. He compared that to how hard his mom worked double shifts and overnights just to provide. That wasn't for Ray. Growing up, when Ray wasn't with his grandparents, he was out on the streets. It's where we spent most of our days when we weren't at school. That's where the AB boys come in.
That Atlantic Beach crew had a huge influence on this town. They were like the surfer, you know, they run the streets, they were doing all like the bad shit in town. All like blue collar families, and they got like all the girls. So like we looked up to them in a way.
They were like the surf gangs from Point Break, just on more drugs. Ray saw the AB crew making more money from drugs than lifeguarding, and he wanted a piece of that. They say Atlantic Beach dies in the winter and comes back to life every June. Summers in Atlantic Beach were special. Even after moving to Florida, I'd go back for the next 5 years. The beach was my first job, where I met my first girlfriend, and where I smoked my first blunt. Most of us were content to just be teenagers and enjoy making a few bucks on the beach. But not Ray. He saw a bigger opportunity than parking his ass on a lifeguard stand. His life of crime? Well, it all started with weed, and it started on the beach.
This boardwalk looks like shit. Like, Long Beach Boardwalk is brand new. This boardwalk looks so shitty. One of the coolest memories, like, for me is, this is actually where I worked when I first sold weed.
And Ray had the perfect cover to get started.
We were chair boys. So, like, there'd be two chair boys and a security guard. And then, like, people would come and they say their last name. You take their chairs, you bring them down for you, and they give you a tip.
Look, as a kid from AB, your summers were spent as a chair boy or a lifeguard. These jobs weren't negotiable. They were passed down from generation to generation. We doted on the rich people of Atlantic Beach as they paid us peanuts to carry their shit. They made leather out of their skin as they parked their ass on the beach all day. Ray realized his time had more value. He also paid attention to who was coming to the beach. It wasn't the people like my father, busting his ass, working 100-hour weeks. These people were comfortable. Some made an honest living. Others, well, Atlantic Beach was a wannabe mob town. You literally had the retired mafia living right there, and a lot of people getting rich off backroom deals, making others do their dirty work while they got fat and tan. Ray took note.
It was just like a good station to set up and bag up my weed. As long as people were getting their chairs, no one's complaining. No one's gonna bother you. I made 10 grand like in eighth grade going into ninth grade, which is like a lot of money for someone that has no money at all.
A 14-year-old walking down the hallways of Lawrence High with 10K in cash.
You know, what am I gonna do? Go make $7 an hour and just sit at the beach?
Hey, I was that kid. I was happy to collect my $7 an hour. Ray, he needed more.
Maybe Johnny worked here more than me. I switched up and started doing other shit.
That other shit Ray got into? Girls and drugs.
I've definitely smoked blunts with girls here and like caught head sitting here. You know, we were little kids just enjoying the day smoking. And there was definitely times where like we'd go and like hook up with girls and do whatever with them.
Right, always got along with women.
That's Mara. The three of us were inseparable in high school. She knows Ray as well as I do.
Everyone would meet up on the beaches at night and get fucked up.
A lot of these girls, like their first time doing anything was with me. You know, for the most part, they're not having sex. Some of these girls are just starting to kiss. I kind of knew everything that was like sexually to do.
And it wasn't just sex.
Ray was always a little bit ridiculous also, in the sense of like he smoked pot before everyone that I ever even met. He was like kind of always the kid that was stoned.
We're introducing them to like everything. The first time everybody does mushrooms is with us, or first time anybody tries to smoke weed is with us. We're like the bad influences. I was probably the worst influence there ever was.
We had plenty of excitement growing up. Smoking weed, breaking into cabanas, partying. It felt like there were no rules. We even had some close encounters with the cops, but we never took it seriously.
Yeah, it was definitely fun running. Well, that was like how it was with the cops. Like, it was just like a cat and mouse game at all times. Enjoyable cat and mouse, because the cops weren't like out to get you. You almost felt like untouchable in that sense.
The reality was, most of those cops were our friends and family. The line between criminal and cop was a thin one.
A lot of the guys that ended up joining the force were some of the biggest scumbags at Lawrence High, so there wasn't really any respect for authority. And as Ray got older, that untouchable mentality persisted.
When you start committing real crimes, you're not really like trying to have any sort of police interaction.
Atlantic Beach had a bad drug problem. That was no secret. And Ray was mixed up in it. We were all worried about him. Here's Mara again.
The dynamic definitely changed at one point because Johnny moved to Florida. And when Johnny moved, it was kind of like the band broke up a little and Ray was doing his own thing.
It was a good time until he started veering off the runway.
That's Ray's childhood friend, Bert Feldman.
It seemed clear that Ray started moving away from weed to harder shit.
You know, anytime you get a bunch of kids together and they got nothing to do, I think leads to drug abuse.
That's Ray's father, Phil Trapani. They aren't exactly close, but Phil came back into the picture.
They would steal their parents' drugs and then they'll put them in a big bowl and they would just share the drugs like that, you know, prescription medication.
Bert, Mara, and I were in no position to really help Ray. We were all dealing with our own substance abuse issues. If I tried to get him clean, he'd be the first to point out the hypocrisy.
Like, I was on a crazy amount of drugs. I was taking 20 Xanax a day, which is, you know, like anybody that ever did one Xanax is like fucked up. Like, I was taking 20 Xanax, smoking weed all day, plus doing heroin with that.
I was definitely concerned when he started doing harder drugs.
Ray's mom, Carrie, had her own concerns.
We stopped hanging out with kids in Atlantic Beach, like with Johnny and stuff like that, and he started to hang out over the bridge. That's when he started to go, you know, because there were bad people over there.
In some neighborhoods, you talk about the wrong side of the tracks. In Atlantic Beach, it's the wrong side of the bridge. Our parents tried to keep us on our side. Here's my sister, Alyssa. She's 3 years older and was a part of that AB crew. She knew all the shit Ray was up to.
When you go over the bridge, it's really only for one thing, and that's to sell drugs.
My other best friend lived over the bridge. I'm at his house regularly smoking pot and all that type of shit. And his brother was like the main weed dealer for all of Nassau County, like a big part of New York. His brother has millions of dollars in cash and hundreds of pounds of weed.
Where Ray was in Inwood, which is a hood part of Queens.
I think I was in like 11th grade. I got my first apartment over the bridge. I've always had like a million apartments, but like Atlantic Beach is my home base.
Lies. He had one. But a 16-year-old having an apartment, still kind of crazy.
I'd kind of sell drugs out of, and that's kind of where I'd bag up coke and just kind of parties if I wanted to do like some ecstasy. You know, we're all just going to go to that apartment.
At this point, not only was Ray an addict, he became a full-blown drug dealer. His main product, Oxy. He was 15.
When you find out how much you pay for one of these pills, that's when Ray's eyes lit up in both ways. Hey, I can sell these drugs and do them for free and make a good profit. Ray was always about the quick come up since an early age.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I don't think start a business. I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme. And I can't help it.
Ray is very much a shady person. He would pick money over everything.
Dealing wasn't enough. Eventually, the future billion-dollar con artist decided to influence the supply.
My first fraud was I basically had someone steal a pad from a doctor, and then I just had someone else go to the doctor, get like a script for like Tylenol. I copied his exact handwriting, so I just wrote out the whole pad of Oxycontin 30s to all different people in my town, made them all go to the pharmacies, cash them in, get the pills, and then I would give them 30 pills each. Most of the scripts are for 120. So you give them 30 pills, which, you know, that makes them like $600 to just basically go into a pharmacy. Per fill, you'd give the person 30 pills, you'd get 90. 90 times 20, you make like $1,800 off each one. You multiply that by 100 people, it's a couple of pennies.
180 grand worth of pennies.
It was crazy how many they allowed us to fill. One pharmacy alone allowed us to fill about 100 prescriptions from the same doctor without ever questioning anything.
Ray practically had the entire town filling fake scripts. He was hustling, selling pills faster than he can swallow them, making bank. But New York's opioid crisis was at a critical mass. The authorities were finally cracking down.
My girlfriend goes into a pharmacy to fill another prescription that's a fake prescription, and she's in there and she just comes like running out, and she says, you know, they were on to the whole scam and we left. They didn't arrest her there. About a week later, detectives showed up to my house. They said that I had a warrant off my arrest for prescription fraud. I think I had like 2 counts because I filled 2 prescriptions personally. They ended up arresting everybody that filled the prescription. Like the whole town basically got arrested. They never pinpointed me as like a mastermind of the operation or anything like that.
Most people I know got off with basically nothing, including Ray. You had to do a couple of weeks at drug court, that's it. And without any real consequences, Ray was back at it in no time, using more than ever. Here's Mara.
He was heavy back on drugs and whatever. The only time we would leave is if like he needed to get drugs, which at first I didn't even realize. And then afterwards I was like, okay, you're like fully back in it.
I used to shoot 2 bundles of heroin, or, you know, 3 bundles of heroin in a day, plus taking Suboxone.
If you don't have a recovering opiate addict in your family, you may not know what Suboxone is. It's a drug that doctors prescribe to treat opiate dependency. Ray used to pop them like candy.
And like, I've had people die right in front of me on heroin, or I've like resuscitated 2 people actually in my life. I somehow saved their life, like gave them mouth to mouth after they overdosed on heroin right in front of me.
His mom definitely was not like helpful in all of that too. Like her and I have actually had like our own kind of beef at one point. Everything was everyone else's fault, never Ray's fault. And she was very vocal about that. She had no problems reaching out to kids and like making them feel like there was something wrong with them. But you know, it's his own issues that he was going through. But she did not help, I don't think.
Ray's mom, Carrie.
I think he probably had multiple rock bottoms, but like they say, you should, you know, let them hit rock bottom. I don't agree with that philosophy. They say, you know, you got to cut them off. I could never do that. I wouldn't be able to sleep. You know, I couldn't live with myself, you know. I couldn't have him in the street. You know, that's why I always gave him a house, a place to live, whatever, you know, food. Even if I knew he was using, because something that I just could not do, I wasn't going to give up on him. People, oh, you're not giving up on him, you're teaching him a lesson. A kid like Ray would have been dead.
Despite their disagreements, Mara knew when it was time to get Carrie involved. She was never one to mince words.
Mara calls me, she's like, he's gonna be mad, but I don't give a shit. He's selling pills, he's selling weed, he's doing this, he's back on the shit. So I got my ass right in the car, I drove right up and just basically shocked him in the middle of the night, banged on his bedroom door. You know, I'm here. What are you doing, idiot? You know, it's not happening.
I was never able to go against Ray like Mara had. I didn't have the balls to call Carrie. But the truth was, we all knew Ray needed rehab.
You know, you read a lot of stories about parents that deal with kids that are having a bad addiction and the kids are telling them off and cursing them. He never did that. It's like he knew he had a problem. He kind of wanted to continue to do his bad stuff, but if I pulled him in and I said, no, hey, we're going, he would come with me. You know, he was in 13 different inpatient rehabs over the course of the 10 years. And then he would come right out and he'd use again.
It's very hard to help Ray. Ray is going to do what he's going to do, through and through.
As soon as he completed rehab, Carrie needed to get him out of Atlantic Beach as fast as possible. So she called her dad for a solution.
My grandfather, who's like the connected mafia type of guy, gets me into construction, and I do that for a few years trying to like remain sober.
I wanted to get him out of the area, so I got him an apartment in Bayonne, New Jersey, and then he was working in the city as a construction worker.
My grandfather got me into the union. I was able to skip the apprenticeship. Then I do construction for about 3 years, and I hate construction. It's not for me. My whole skill set is all brain, and I'm so skinny and not strong.
He was a recovering drug addict. The kid was like 90 pounds.
He's like, Mom, I'm not happy. And I knew he wasn't happy. He hated construction. It's not his personality. He just hated the guys. He hated the work.
I got disgusted with construction, and I go down to visit Bert in Florida.
Bert, Ray's childhood friend we met before, was living down in Florida at the time.
He calls me and he's like, you know, Ma, it's so nice down here. Birkin hooked me up with a job. You know, what do you think if I move down? And at this point, he is relatively sober. He's on Suboxone, but he's clean off of everything else. I'm like, you know, Ray, 24, if I had the opportunity to just pick up and go and had no kids, I would do it. Do it.
I'm like, fuck it. I quit. I pack up. I put my TV, all my shit in my car. I drive down to Florida and I ended up moving in with Bert.
Ray's choice to go to Florida was just the beginning. This decision would fundamentally change the course of his life. He needed a fresh start, and Bert offered that. Growing up, my friend did a lot of shitty things. He was no saint. By the time he left New York, he was a career criminal. Little did I realize, he was just warming up. And that's where our story really begins. On this season of Creating a Con,
I went from working construction, hating my life, to making 9 grand, 10 grand, 12 grand in a day, just living like a maniac.
You'll hear the highs.
We had an amazing life. We would all go to courtside Miami Heat games, dinners wherever we wanted, spending any amount we wanted.
That first feeling of seeing $1 million in your bank account, you see that extra comma, I was like, oh my God, this is crazy.
And the lows.
My whole life, it was always living up to my grandfather. I would never be able to face him if I lost that money.
I realized this was not going to end well for them, and they didn't seem to understand that.
A story that by the end blurs the line between fact and fiction.
Because once somebody tells a lie enough, they believe that lie.
So tune in each week to learn the truth behind Ray Trapani and CentraTech. To get an inside look into CentraTech, Ray Trapani, and all the characters you've been listening to, check out BitCon, exclusively on Netflix, available to stream now. If you would like to reach out to the Creating a Con team, email us at creatingacon@gmail.com. That's creatingacon@gmail.com. We appreciate your support. One way to support our show is by subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review Creating a Con. 5-star reviews go a long way. A big thank you to those who are listening. Also, be sure to check us out and follow us on Instagram at Glass Podcasts. Creating a Con is a production of Glass Podcasts, a division of Glass Entertainment Group in partnership with iHeart Podcasts. The show is hosted and produced by me, Johnny B. Good, with executive producers Nancy Glass, Ben Fetterman, and Andrea Gunning. Written and produced by Ben Fetterman and Todd Gans. Additional writing by Matt Delvecchio. Operations and production support by Kristen Melchiori. Additional production support, Trey Morgan. Our iHeart team is Ali Perry and Jessica Kreinchek. Sound editing and mixing by Matt Delvecchio. Consulting producer, Nathaniel Popper. Creating a Con's theme composed by Oliver Baines. Music library provided by Mibe Music. Thank you for subscribing to iHeart True Crime Plus, exclusively on Apple. We hope you enjoyed this ad-free presentation of Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Continue binging the rest of the series, 100% ad-free, and stay tuned for early access to bonus episodes and additional content, exclusively for subscribers. And for more podcasts from iHeart and Glass Podcasts, visit the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.